This is Nightly Business Report with Tyler Matheson and Sue Herrera.
Broad rally, stocks rebound from yesterday's steep sell-off as investors try to figure out what to expect in the months ahead.
Bucking the trend, Walmart did what a lot of retailers could not: get more customers into its stores and more sales online.
Policy shift: why the company that started the remote working revolution is now calling employees back to the office. Those stories and more tonight on Nightly Business Report for Thursday, May 18th.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. Investors put money back into stocks as the market recovered from its worst drop of the year. Early on, it seemed that today would be another rough one, but that wasn't the case. At one point, the Dow was actually up triple digits. The closing numbers look like this. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 56 points to 20,663. The NASDAQ rose 43, and the S&P 500 was up 8. Bob Pisani spent the day at the New York Stock Exchange figuring out why stocks got a lift.
Yesterday's sell-off is a one-day event, at least so far. Traders have been nervous going into the open because yesterday a lot of big institutional traders were selling stocks. The concern was that the big players would continue to sell today. That did not happen. Wall Street strategists also do not appear ruffled by the wild ride yesterday. No strategists were taking down their estimates for future stock gains, at least not yet. J.P. Morgan told clients they were still sticking by their year-end price target of 2,400 on the S&P 500, just above where it is now, and raised their earnings estimates because corporate guidance has really been strong. Elsewhere, an accident in Times Square in the middle of the day that caused the death of one pedestrian caught the attention of traders, but it does appear to be an accident and not terror-related. The markets did rise briefly midday on erroneous headlines from bloggers regarding Jim Comey's May 3rd testimony before Congress. Comey was asked in the video whether the Attorney General or senior Justice Department officials had ever asked him to halt an investigation. Bloggers misconstrued the video to mean neither Trump nor anyone else had ever asked Comey to end a probe. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Bob Pisani at the New York Stock Exchange.
Hugh Johnson, who's seen a lot of stuff over the years, joins us now to discuss what we can expect from the markets in the month ahead. Hugh, I'm so glad to have you here tonight because, like me, your sense of history and Sue's as well goes back through many crises over the years.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How should we think mm-hmm. about what's going on now as an investor, and how can we keep cool heads when the headlines are so hot?
It's not easy to do. And I remember, of course, the Nixon crisis and the Clinton crisis, and it was even though we tried to keep our heads, even though we tried to focus on what really counts, which of course are earnings and the economy and things of that sort, the truth was in both periods we were very focused, very obsessively so, on what was going on in Washington, and that was true in both of those instances, and I think it's going to be true in this instance as well. And occasionally, periodically, we're going to get some sort of a shock that suggests that the president is going to be impeached or something's going to happen in Washington. And that could cause a real ripple through the markets, a real decline. So this is going to be very much, I think, you know, we're going to be walking on hot coals for the next foreseeable future, 3 to 6 months. And there could be some fairly sharp corrections along the way if we get some bad news on the outcome for the presidency or the administration.
If I'm hearing you correctly, Hugh, you seem to be saying we can't really gauge from those past periods of time because we were in very different financial and economic circumstances for the Nixon era and also for the Clinton era.
Yeah, very different. The Nixon era was as dismal as it gets. Not only were interest rates, the inflation went from 3 to 10% to 11%. The economy went into a recession. We were focused on the deterioration in not only earnings, but the stock market itself. So we were obsessed with that. But there still was a lot of focus on Washington. But it was very bad mm-hmm. times.
You know, I
Clinton
know
administration during the Clinton.
Please, Hugh, I thought we were wrapping up. Go ahead. Finish the thought on Clinton.
Well, the only thing I'd say is that Clinton was entirely different. The economy was expanding. Things were really good. And so the markets performed well. Generally, markets performed poorly in the Nixon period because of bad fundamentals. Markets performed well during the Clinton period because of good fundamentals. But there were shocks along the way. and they caused real ripples or declines in the Clinton era.
So what should I do? What would you like to tell our viewers who are investors that they should be wary of or maybe take advantage of? And I'm going to ask you to cheer me up a little bit, Hugh. The economy's pretty good, right? Unemployment is way down, and incomes are moving up a little bit. It's not all that bad.
Yeah. No, it's not, and the fundamentals are good. We have further to go in the current sort of stock market, economic interest rate cycle, so you should maintain a meaningful allocation in your portfolio to stocks. The stock market over time is going to be fine. I think this is going to be a little bit of a testy period for two reasons. One is valuation is not particularly good. I think we've discounted all the good news that I see from the so-called Trump stimulus, if we ever do get it. So that's one thing. We've already discounted it. And and what I'm simply would suggest to investors, maintain a high allocation to equities, but make sure you're very patient and very good at picking entry points. A good entry point to this stock market where it's not so valuation problems are not so lofty is lower than current levels. That's not 2350, that's 2300 or even lower. So be patient and pick your entry levels and be a good stock picker.
Thanks for your wisdom tonight, Hugh. Always good to see you. Hugh Johnson with Hugh Johnson Advisors.
My pleasure.
It was a better-than-expected quarter for the world's largest retailer. Walmart topped earnings estimates and reported growth in key areas. That helped lift shares more than 3%, making it the best-performing stock in the Dow Index. Courtney Reagan takes a look at why Walmart's business is thriving in such a challenging environment.
Many retailers are struggling, but right now, Walmart isn't one of them. Investors are focusing on the world's largest retailer's growth streak. Walmart has grown U.S. comparable sales for nearly three straight years, and much of that from an increase in customers. An impressive feat for a retailer of its size, especially in today's difficult retail environment. Plus, its forecast for the current quarter's comparable sales is stronger than analysts were expecting. While the stores still generate most of Walmart's sales, its digital sales grew more than 60% from last year. Walmart has a long way to go to catch up to Amazon online. Walmart's total sales, though, are 3.5 times bigger than Amazon's.
This is a company that is generating traffic not only in bricks and mortar, but on e-commerce. And you just don't see that anywhere in retail. So, I mean, if you're going to pick a winner, Walmart's definitely one of them.
More people are buying groceries at Walmart, too. In fact, the most in 3 years. Food makes up more than half of Walmart's total sales. The average receipt did fall somewhat, in part due to Walmart lowering prices and lower sales of more expensive items at the beginning of the quarter. But in a retail wreck, Walmart is a bright spot. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Courtney Reagan.
Well, in the midst of a political crisis, or at least controversy, President Trump hosted a news conference at the White House with the president of Colombia. He was directly asked about the Russian investigation and his conversation with the then director of the FBI, Comey.
Did you at any time urge former FBI Director James Comey in any way, shape, or form to close or to back down the investigation into Michael Flynn? And also, as you look back...
No. Next question.
The president also said, speaking for himself, there was no collusion with Russia, and he called the entire investigation a witch hunt. As we have been reporting, investors are watching what's happening in Washington because the events there threaten to interfere, at the very least, with the administration's business-friendly reforms.
The Trump administration formally told Congress that it intends to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement, otherwise known as NAFTA. The two-page letter offered few details about what changes the White House wants to make to the 23-year-old pact between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. But the U.S. trade representative, the administration's main trade negotiator, said the motive is to renegotiate the deal rather than scrap it. During the campaign, the president called it a horrible deal for the U.S. and possibly the worst trade deal ever.
Also in Washington, the Federal Communications Commission voted to begin undoing some of the rules governing the Internet, rules put in place during the Obama administration. The current regulations make it illegal for Internet service providers like AT&T and Verizon to block or slow down websites for consumers. The companies have argued that softer regulations would let them raise capital and allow them to do things like upgrade their networks. The FCC will start taking public feedback on the proposal. It could be put to a vote, a final one, later this year.
The biggest gathering of cancer doctors in the whole world takes place in early June. But already, some new data on what could be promising new treatments are being released. Meg Terrell has more on the companies behind the drugs.
The American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, or ASCO, officially starts June 2nd. But last night, the conference released more than 5,000 pieces of research in advance, giving analysts, investors, and those in the medical community a preview of what's to come.
There are 40,000 people who attend who all are involved in some way with treating patients with cancer.
The Cleveland Clinic's Dr. Dale Shepard says key themes are precision medicine and immunotherapy, medicines that reveal cancer cells to the body's own immune system, enabling our natural defenses to attack it.
Really trying to figure out what therapies are best for individual patients is, you know, we used to have a handful of chemotherapy drugs that we would give to people in sort of a non-discriminatory way, and now we really truly realize that some patients will do better with some therapies compared to others, and can we pick the best therapy for each patient?
The biggest companies in the space are Merck, Bristol-Myers Squibb, AstraZeneca, Roche, and Pfizer. The drugs have presented a new way to treat cancer, generating results that have excited the medical community. It was Merck's Keytruda that former President Jimmy Carter credited in late 2015 with completely shrinking the brain tumors associated with his stage 4 melanoma. Not all patients see such a dramatic benefit. So a key strategy for drug developers is combination therapy, finding out whether putting multiple drugs together produces better responses.
Some patients don't respond or they don't respond for very long. So we're really trying to understand more to the next level.
These research updates frequently move stocks as drug makers are competing for a big market in immunotherapy alone.
It's a very large opportunity. The estimates out there that are being used by investors are anywhere between $30 to $40 billion. And what investors are trying to figure out is, how do you divvy that up?
One company cheered by Wall Street today was Incyte. Its shares spiked after one of its experimental drugs showed promising results in combination studies with drugs from both Merck and Bristol-Myers in a number of different cancer types. Incyte's drug is another in the class of immunotherapy drugs. With combination therapy looking like the future of cancer treatment, another question arises: cost. With many of the newest cancer drugs priced at more than $10,000 a month, many worry that taking multiple medicines will drive costs too high. It's sure to be a key part of conversations at the conference in Chicago, along with a lot more research on new approaches to treating cancer. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Meg Terrell.
Still ahead, role reversal. Why IBM, which once encouraged working from home, is changing its tune. The number of people filing for jobless benefits fell last week. According to the Labor Department, initial claims for unemployment benefits dropped 4,000 to 232,000 last week. Claims have been below the key 300,000 level for 115 straight weeks.
IBM is shifting its policy on working from home and calling workers back into the office. In a reversal of the work from home movement that it pioneered, the tech giant now says its remote employees must come back to a regional office or leave the company. Could we see other companies follow IBM's move? Joining us is Eric Gordon, professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Good to see you again, Professor Gordon. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Sue.
What do you make of IBM's move? There are some who say that this is basically the company's way of shrinking its workforce, giving employees a choice, but as a result, if you leave, they shrink the workforce. Others say it's better to be in an office for the collaborative type of environment that fosters.
You know, this is one where you just have to ask yourself, what were they thinking? Now, if what they're thinking is this is a backdoor way of shrinking our workforce because people don't want to travel 2 hours to one of these locations, then it's smart. But if that's not their intent, it doesn't seem smart at all.
What has been the experience of other companies that have done this, have reversed these kinds of policies? I'm thinking of Yahoo, I believe Bank of America, and others.
Yeah, so it varies depending on what your company is. If you're a bank or an insurance company, most of your workers aren't tech workers. They probably like coming to work. In fact, when you told them to work from home, they thought they were losing their workspace. But at real tech companies, like Yahoo or any of the rest of them, it's a terrible idea because the workers don't want to come to work. They want to work from their kitchen. They want to work in their pajamas. They want to work at midnight. They don't want to get dressed. They don't want to wash. They don't want to go to the office, and they don't want to be in a cubicle.
This is painting a wonderful picture of the American worker, Eric.
Is that why you say it's not a good move for IBM, if indeed their motive is more collaboration or something along those lines?
Yeah, first of all, they're not going to get more collaboration. They'll get more people yakking in front of the microwave. But you can collaborate substantively electronically. Even professors do it, much less tech people. Tech people are really used to collaborating that way. And if IBM wants to be able to recruit the best tech workers for its supposedly advanced cognitive computing, machine learning, it needs to recruit really smart young people who just don't want to come in to an IBM or anybody's office.
Do you see any irony or analogy in the idea that when Yahoo did it, its CEO, Marissa Mayer, was under pressure, and Ginni Rometty is under pressure, too?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that. I mean, IBM has, for five straight years, every quarter's revenues have been less than the year before. Mm-hmm. She's tried a lot of ideas. People are getting, investors are getting really impatient about why she can't get revenue moving. This is going to be seen by some investors as pretty desperate. If this is her next best idea, I don't think it's going to play well in the investment community.
Got it. Eric, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Eric Gordon with the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
Next time he's going to do the interview from home.
Excellent. In his pajamas.
General Motors is pulling out of two foreign markets, and that is where we begin tonight's Market Focus. The automaker will shed its South African business and stop selling cars in India as it focuses on its efforts on more profitable markets. The company will still build cars in India for export. GM shares up a fraction at $32.47. The Children's Place said same-store sales rose more than expected as more customers visited the kids' clothing chain. Total profit and revenue also grew, topped estimates, and the company raised its full-year earnings outlook. But still, shares finished the day down 50 cents at $111.10.
Pandora is reportedly in talks again with SiriusXM about a potential merger. According to reports, Sirius is considering making a bid for the music streaming company and has started conversations with Pandora's banks. Pandora rejected a takeover offer from Sirius last year. Pandora's shares popped 5.5% to $9.42. And Gap said strength in its Old Navy brand helped it post a rise in same-store sales. Profit and revenue at the clothing chain also beat forecasts, and the Gap reaffirmed its outlook for 2017. The shares initially rose after the bell, but ended the regular session down more than 1% to $23.19.
The marijuana industry is one of the fastest growing in the country. Medicinal use now legal in more than half of the states, but will the Trump White House put up some roadblocks to further legalization? Kate Rogers reports from Oxon Hill, Maryland.
With a new and potentially less friendly administration at the helm in Washington, the marijuana industry is wondering what the future holds. Investors, regulators, and entrepreneurs gathered in Oxon Hill, Maryland this week for the Marijuana Business Daily Conference and Expo. The issue on everyone's mind, will the Trump administration hinder the cannabis industry's record growth? Both Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Press Secretary Sean Spicer have signaled the potential for tougher regulation on the drug, which is still considered illegal by the federal government.
The noise that we're hearing from Washington, D.C. is going to stifle growth. It's probably going to slow down medical states and prevent people from gaining access to cannabis as a plant medicine. I think they're doing the cannabis industry and the citizens of the United States a great disservice.
Right now, cannabis is legal for recreational use in 8 states and Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, medicinal cannabis is legal in more than half the country. Retail sales are projected to hit between $6 and $7.5 billion in 2017. And what's more, Marijuana Business Daily projects the entire cannabis industry will have an economic impact of some $68 billion by the year 2021.
But for entrepreneurs, there are still major hurdles, from taxation regulations to finding and keeping banking relationships, forcing many to operate on cash alone. Cannabis businesses often struggle to find banks willing to work with them, as many financial institutions are fearful of running afoul of federal law.
What the banks need to hear from this administration is that they are continued to respect and adhere to the policies that are already in place that lay out a path for how banks can permissibly bank this space.
Even with unknowns ahead, some marijuana advocates are hopeful legalization will continue and financial progress will follow.
I've worked on this issue for decades all over the country. I've never met a single person that thinks there's any good purpose for forcing this industry to be conducted on an all-cash basis. If you care about money laundering, tax evasion, robbery, it's insane. And I think we're positioned that we can take care of this even while we're dealing with larger issues of legalization.
For Nightly Business Report, Kate Rogers, Oxon Hill, Maryland.
Coming up, priceless? What happens when that work of art or sports memorabilia are no longer worth what you thought they were?
Leon Cooperman's Omega Advisors has settled with the Securities and Exchange Commission for nearly $5 million. Last fall, the SEC accused the hedge fund manager of insider trading, charges he said were without merit. Cooperman admitted to no wrongdoing.
A settlement in the years-long memorabilia suit involving New York Giants and quarterback Eli Manning could be coming. According to the New York Daily News, the suit alleges that Manning and the Giants knowingly created and distributed fake game-used items, an allegation they both denied.
Well, last night we told you that this is a big, maybe even a huge week for the art market, with more than $1 billion worth of art expected to be auctioned in New York City. Have you ever thought about the people who determine the value of artwork or other collectibles? When their opinion on what a collectible is worth changes, it could mean millions. Andrea Day has the story.
When they change their minds about the authenticity of a work, the market rises and falls with that.
A Cezanne bought at Sotheby's and exhibited around the world.
First through the Royal Academy, then the National Academy, and then the Museum d'Orsay before being sold at Sotheby's.
This is as stellar exhibition history as you can get.
And included in the artist's catalog raisonné, or complete list of his paintings. Here it is.
Inclusion in the catalog raisonné is generally deemed to be an authentication.
Was there any doubt at all in their minds that this was a Cezanne?
Nobody at the time could have had any doubt.
But years later, when attorney Judd Grossman's client tried to sell.
The work is unsalable, unmarketable, and virtually worthless.
A case, he says, where expert opinions just changed over time.
The authors of the online catalog raisonné project have determined that they just don't believe it's by Cezanne's hand.
The painting, not included in a new expert's catalog.
It's not the first time, and it won't be the last.
And he says it can happen for a number of reasons. New scientific methods that come out, information about the work's history or past owners, or just new generations of experts. We reached out to Sotheby's but did not get a response.
So how many millions could be lost here when opinions change?
Countless, countless. And that can happen in the blink of an eye.
And it's not just art. At Golden Auctions, sales of sports collectibles topped $25 million last year.
Billionaires buy sports teams. The multimillionaires buy sports collectibles.
But he's seen entire collections go south. One where $20 million worth of goods were auctioned off, including game-used jerseys. He says later found to be counterfeit.
As the years went by and authentication standards and techniques became more advanced, those items were reevaluated. For a collector, everything revolves around who they're purchasing the item from and who is authenticating it.
So he offers collector's insurance just in case things change.
That would allow us to reimburse that customer for this event happening because we sold it as authentic.
And when it comes to priceless art,
not including a work in the catalog essentially is the same as saying it's not right, and no explanation beyond that is really necessary.
And he says even the courts won't usually go against it. His best advice, do your due diligence before the sale to minimize any risk. But even with all of that, just know that opinions can change. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Andrea Day.
Roger Ailes, the man who helped create and build a cable news empire, has died at the age of 77. He died from a fall at his home. He was a titan of media industry, turning Fox News into a ratings juggernaut. But as Julia Boorstin reports, he was also very controversial.
Roger Ailes was founding CEO of Fox News in 1996 and became chairman of the Fox TV stations group as well in 2005. He was ousted last July following a sexual harassment scandal and a series of lawsuits. In the five decades prior, Ailes rose to become one of the most powerful people in American media, building the Fox News Channel into a billion-dollar brand and transforming the cable news landscape into what it is today. In addition to building FNC into a news powerhouse, Ailes was president of CNBC for 3 years before launching Fox. He also consulted to Republican presidents Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George Bush, and advised President Trump's campaign, helping with debate prep. 21st Century Fox and Fox News Channel executive chairman Rupert Murdoch saying, "A brilliant broadcaster, Roger played a huge role in shaping America's media over the last 30 years. And at 21st Century Fox, we will always be enormously grateful for the great business he built." A controversial figure, he forged an indelible mark on the American cultural landscape. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Julia Boorstin.
And that is Nightly Business Report for tonight. I'm Sue Herrera. Thanks for joining us.
And I'm Tyler Matheson. Have a great evening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.